Adam Smith really warrants being revisited several times through one's life. And I don't mean what ponies, what write secondary writings about Adam Smith. I'm talking about Reed Smith. He's wonderfully candid. He says before the 15th page in the book that there's no difference between the children of the farm serf and the children of the duke. I could have kissed him for saying that. He said, except the early training. Now, I said to David Bowes of the Cato Institute, I said, David, you can't pick and choose from Adam Smith. If you're going to sell me Adam Smith as a secular saint, then actually read what he said. Smith said that if you gave educational schooling, that's his exact phrase, to ordinary people, the whole social order would be turned on its head. And lots of unlikely people would become the bosses, and lots of even unlikelier people would become the clerks and the serfs. You only have to read the first 15 pages. I've never encountered anyone who claimed to be a fan of Adam Smith who seems to have bothered to read that. But he's quite clear.
Well, it's funny that you should bring up Smith because I was doing an interview last night with Stephen Zerlinga from the American Monetary Institute, and he was wanting to speak with you, so.
Oh, I shall be glad to.
Okay, I'll send him your contact information. Let me ask you about Kant. We haven't covered Kant yet.
Emmanuel, the professor, he's the head of the philosophy department at the University of Berlin, and I understand from philosophically sophisticated people, and that which I would hardly claim to be one of, but I understand that Kant stands right with Plato as one of the two most influential philosophers in history. I guess Hegel would make a triumvirate because in the last couple of 100 years, seems to me that Hegel has been the master. Remember, if I could be allowed to just finish your earlier question about Hegel. Hegel said that you could actually bring human history, not human life, but human history to a close. He said, if the last argument is argued out, history will freeze and never change again, and the people at the top will remain at the top forever. Well, this intrigued an awful lot of big shot industrialists who said, well, you know, one way is to follow Hegel's suggestion that you just let all these wars and arguments be argued, and eventually there won't be anything, and they'll all be settled. But another way is to remove the brain core from most people so they're incapable of arguing. What they consider argument is actually just whining and complaining. They can't formulate nor sustain an argument. So here is certainly another piece of the foundation of institutional schooling. You know, you make nice, right? There's no arguments in textbooks because everything is settled. No one ever bothers to say, well, this is one way to look at it, but here's an entirely different way to look. You don't do that. In Jesuit boarding schools, where I went, you do that as early as third grade, but in public schools, including the gift and talent, you don't do that. So the ability to argue is gone, and that makes it so much easier for management. And also, oh, this is a trifle cynical, so much easier for the architects bringing this about, because they're already pretty well placed, and now, if Hegel's correct, they'll remain well placed. And so we're talking about Immanuel Kant now. I mean, Kant is a titanic thinker. His four major books, the two best known are Critique of Pure Reason and the Critique of Practical Reason. But the two other influential ones, whose titles hit me now, he translates very, very badly to start with. So you've really got to grit your teeth and put yourself in a little society of like-minded people to be able to extract much from Kant. But Kant is the only major philosopher who ever put forth a creditable argument for the existence of God. It's just fascinating. Maybe one reason, he doesn't occur very often in American universities, because he's anathema to the secular crowd. Kant's disciple, who inherited his chair at the University of Berlin, was the ever popular creator of the addresses to the German nation, which gave us the template for our schooling. And we talked about him yesterday. So Kant's interesting because he more or less stands astride the years when the new United States was coming into being and finding his feet. He was apparently well known to our so-called founding fathers, as was Spinoza. But Johann Fichte was his heir. And the University of Berlin wasn't, it's very misleading to try to compare the university scene now to the one that existed then. We pay deference and lip service to Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, but actually their relative position in the university pantheon is much diminished. Whereas the University of Berlin essentially stood alone astride the university world globally. It was where you took your final appeal to what was going on there. And it was pretty much the first, not purely, but almost purely research university. Its stated alliance was with the lords of the economy and the lords of government. It did not exist to educate undergraduates. They were raw material to be chewed up, and a few of them resurrected. If you read Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, published about 1620 or 30, Bacon creates this model of a research university that draws from all over the place the best people and produces intelligence, not for everybody, for the kings of the economy and the lords of the government. I would say that New Atlantis, which survives as a fragment, it's not even the whole thing, has got to be one of the two dozen most influential documents in the history of mankind, which, of course, is another reason why it isn't read or even heard about in schooling.
Well, if I had to name one key area of omission from my schooling, that would be who creates money and how. And I'm glad to say that that seems to be becoming more important in people's minds. Those who reckon they could suppress that information seem to me to be on the losing side of what Ivan Illich would call a convivial technology, as opposed to manipulative institutions which bend people's beliefs and actions to their own purposes. World Wide Web, I think he would have classed as convivial because it was there if we wanted it and didn't greatly alter reality for those who didn't. Now let's hear more on that, I think, very important dichotomy from Ivan Illich, perhaps the greatest thinker of the 20th century to have fallen down the memory hole because his ideas were just too insightful to be widely broadcast.
Deschooling Society by Ivan Illich, Chapter 4, Institutional Spectrum. Most utopian schemes and futuristic scenarios call for new and costly technologies, which would have to be sold to rich and poor nations alike. Herman Kahn has found pupils in Venezuela, Argentina, and Colombia. The pipe dreams of Sergio Bernardes for his Brazil of the year 2000 sparkle with more new machinery than is now possessed by the United States, which by then will be weighted down with the antiquated missile sites, jet ports, and cities of the 60s and 70s. Futurists inspired by Buckminster Fuller would depend on cheaper and more exotic devices. They count on the acceptance of a new but possible technology that would apparently allow us to make more with less. Lightweight monorails rather than supersonic transport. Vertical living rather than horizontal sprawling. All of today's futuristic planners seek to make economically feasible what is technically possible while refusing to face the inevitable social consequence, the increased craving of all men for goods and services that will remain the privilege of a few. I believe that a desirable future depends on our deliberately choosing a life of action over a life of consumption, on our engendering a lifestyle which will enable us to be spontaneous, independent, yet related to each other, rather than maintaining a lifestyle which only allows us to make and unmake, produce and consume, a style of life which is merely a way station on the road to the depletion and pollution of the environment. The future depends more upon our choice of institutions which support a life of action than on our developing new ideologies and technologies. We need a set of criteria which will permit us to recognize those institutions which support personal growth rather than addiction, as well as the will to invest our technological resources preferentially in such institutions of growth. The choice is between two radically opposed institutional types, both of which are exemplified in certain existing institutions, although one type so characterizes the contemporary period as to almost define it. This dominant type I would propose to call the manipulative institution. The other type also exists, but only precariously. The institutions which fit it are humbler and less noticeable, yet I take them as models for a more desirable future. I call them convivial, and suggest placing them at the left of an institutional spectrum, both to show that there are institutions which fall between the extremes, and to illustrate how historical institutions can change color as they shift from facilitating activity to organizing production. Generally, such a spectrum, moving from left to right, has been used to characterize men and their ideologies, not our social institutions and their styles. This categorization of men, whether as individuals or in groups, often generates more heat than light. Weighty objections can be raised against using an ordinary convention in an unusual fashion, but by doing so, I hope to shift the terms of the discussion from a sterile to a fertile plane. It will become evident that men of the left are not always characterized by their opposition to the manipulative institutions, which I locate to the right on the spectrum. The most influential modern institutions crowd up at the right of the spectrum, Law enforcement has moved there, as it has shifted from the hands of the sheriff to those of the FBI and the Pentagon. Modern warfare has become a highly professional enterprise whose business is killing. It has reached the point where its efficiency is measured in body counts. Its peacekeeping potential depends on its ability to convince friend and foe of the nation's unlimited death-dealing power. Modern bullets and chemicals are so effective that a few cents worth, properly delivered to the intended client, unfailingly kill or maim. But delivery costs rise vertiginously. The cost of a dead Vietnamese went from $360,000 in 1967 to $450,000 in 1969. Only economies on a scale approaching race suicide would render modern warfare economically efficient. The boomerang effect in war is becoming more obvious. The higher the body count of dead Vietnamese, the more enemies the United States acquires around the world. Likewise, the more the United States must spend to create another manipulative institution, cynically dubbed pacification, in a futile effort to absorb the side effects of war. At the same extreme on the spectrum, we also find social agencies which specialize in the manipulation of their clients. Like the military, they tend to develop effects contrary to their aims as the scope of their operations increases. These social institutions are equally counterproductive, but less obviously so. Many assume a therapeutic and compassionate image to mask this paradoxical effect. For example, jails, up until two centuries ago, served as a means of detaining men until they were sentenced, maimed, killed, or exiled, and were sometimes deliberately used as a form of torture. Only recently have we begun to claim that locking people up in cages will have a beneficial effect upon their character and behavior. Now, quite a few people are beginning to understand that jail increases both the quality and the quantity of criminals, that, in fact, it often creates them out of mere nonconformists. Far fewer people, however, seem to understand that mental hospitals, nursing homes, and orphan asylums do much the same thing. These institutions provide their clients with the destructive self-image of the psychotic, the overaged, or the waif, and provide a rationale for the existence of entire professions, just as jails produce income for wardens. Membership in the institutions found at this extreme of the spectrum is achieved in two ways, both coercive, by forced commitment or by selective service. At the opposite extreme of the spectrum lie institutions distinguished by spontaneous use, the convivial institutions. Telephone link-ups, subway lines, mail routes, public markets, and exchanges do not require hard or soft sells to induce their clients to use them. Sewage systems, drinking water, parks, and sidewalks are institutions men use without having to be institutionally convinced that it is to their advantage to do so. Of course, all institutions require some regulation, but the operation of institutions which exist to be used, rather than to produce something, requires rules of an entirely different nature from those required by treatment institutions, which are manipulative. The rules which govern institutions for use have mainly the purpose of avoiding abuses, which would frustrate their general accessibility. Sidewalks must be kept free of obstructions. The industrial use of drinking water must be held within limits, and ball playing must be restricted to special areas within a park. At present, we need legislation to limit the abuse of our telephone lines by computers, the abuse of mail service by advertisers, and the pollution of our sewage systems by industrial waste. The regulation of convivial institutions sets limits to their use. As one moves from the convivial to the manipulative end of the spectrum, the rules progressively call for unwilling consumption or participation. The different cost of acquiring clients is just one of the characteristics which distinguish convivial from manipulative institutions. At both extremes of the spectrum, we find service institutions. But on the right, the service is imposed manipulation, and the client is made the victim of advertising, aggression, indoctrination, imprisonment, or electroshock. On the left, the service is amplified opportunity within formally defined limits, while the client remains a free agent. Right-wing institutions tend to be highly complex and costly production processes in which much of the elaboration and expense is concerned with convincing consumers that they cannot live without the product or the treatment offered by the institution. Left-wing institutions tend to be networks which facilitate client-initiated communication or cooperation. The manipulative institutions of the right are either socially or psychologically addictive. Social addiction or escalation consists in the tendency to prescribe increased treatment if smaller quantities have not yielded the desired results. Psychological addiction or habituation results when consumers become hooked on the need for more and more of the process or product. The self-activated institutions of the left tend to be self-limiting. Unlike production processes, which identify satisfaction with the mere act of consumption, these networks serve a purpose beyond their own repeated use. An individual picks up the telephone when he wants to say something to someone else, and hangs up when the desired communication is over. He does not, teenagers excepted, use the telephone for the sheer pleasure of talking into the receiver. If the telephone is not the best way to get in touch, people will write a letter or take a trip. Right-wing institutions, as we can see clearly in the case of schools, both invite compulsively repetitive use and frustrate alternative ways of achieving similar results. Toward, but not at, the left in the institutional spectrum, we can locate enterprises which compete with others in their own field, but have not begun notably to engage in advertising. Here we find hand laundries, small bakeries, hairdressers, and, to speak of professionals, some lawyers and music teachers. Characteristically left of center, then, are self-employed persons who have institutionalized their services, but not their publicity. They acquire clients through their personal touch and the comparative quality of their services. Hotels and cafeterias are somewhat closer to the center. The big chains like Hilton, which spend huge amounts on selling their image, often behave as if they were running institutions of the right. Yet Hilton and Sheraton Enterprises do not usually offer anything more, in fact they often give less, than similarly priced, independently managed lodgings. Essentially, a hotel sign beckons to a traveler in the manner of a road sign. It says, "Stop, here is a bed for you," rather than, "You should prefer a hotel bed to a park bench." The producers of staples and most perishable consumer goods belong in the middle of our spectrum. They fill generic demands and add to the cost of production and distribution whatever the market will bear in advertising costs for publicity and special packaging. The more basic the product, be it goods or services, the more does competition tend to limit the sales cost of the item. Most manufacturers of consumer goods have moved much further to the right. Both directly and indirectly, they produce demands for accessories which boost real purchase price far beyond production cost. General Motors and Ford produce means of transportation, but they also, and more importantly, manipulate public taste in such a way that the need for transportation is expressed as a demand for private cars rather than public buses. They sell the desire to control a machine, to race at high speeds in luxurious comfort, while also offering the fantasy at the end of the road. What they sell, however, is not just a matter of uselessly big motors, superfluous gadgetry, or the new extras forced on the manufacturers by Ralph Nader and the clean air lobbyist. The list price includes souped-up engines, air conditioning, safety belts, and exhaust controls. But other costs not openly declared to the driver are also involved. The corporation's advertising and sales expenses, fuel, maintenance and parts, insurance, interest on credit, as well as less tangible costs like loss of time, temper, and breathable air in our traffic-congested cities. An especially interesting corollary to our discussion of socially useful institutions is the system of public highways. This major element of the total cost of automobiles deserves lengthier treatment, since it leads directly to the rightist institution in which I am most interested, namely the school. False public utilities. The highway system is a network for locomotion across relatively large distances. As a network, it appears to belong on the left of the institutional spectrum. But here we must make a distinction which will clarify both the nature of highways and the nature of true public utilities. Genuinely all-purpose roads are true public utilities. Superhighways are private preserves, the cost of which has been partially foisted upon the public. Telephone, postal, and highway systems are all networks, and none of them is free. Access to the telephone network is limited by time charges on each call. These rates are relatively small and could be reduced without changing the nature of the system. Use of the telephone system is not in the least limited by what is transmitted, although it is best used by those who can speak coherent sentences in the language of the other party, an ability universally possessed by those who wish to use the network. Postage is usually cheap. Use of the postal system is slightly limited by the price of pen and paper and somewhat more by the ability to write. Still, when someone who does not know how to write has a relative or friend to whom he can dictate a letter, the postal system is at his service, as it is if he wants to ship a recorded tape. The highway system does not similarly become available to someone who merely learns to drive. The telephone and postal networks exist to serve those who wish to use them, while the highway system mainly serves as an accessory to the private automobile. The former are true public utilities, whereas the latter is a public service to the owners of cars, trucks, and buses. Public utilities exist for the sake of communication among men. Highways, like other institutions of the right, exist for the sake of a product. Auto manufacturers, we have already observed, produce simultaneously both cars and the demand for cars. They also produce the demand for multi-lane highways, bridges, and oil fields. The private car is the focus of a cluster of right-wing institutions. The high cost of each element is dictated by elaboration of the basic product, and to sell the basic product is to hook society on the entire package. To plan a highway system as a true public utility would discriminate against those for whom velocity and individualized comfort are the primary transportation values, in favor of those who value fluidity and destination. It is the difference between a far-flung network with maximum access for travelers and one which offers only privileged access to restricted areas. Transferring a modern institution to the developing nations provides the acid test of its quality. In very poor countries, roads are usually just good enough to permit transit by special high-axle trucks loaded with groceries, livestock, or people. This kind of country should use its limited resources to build a spider web of trails extending to every region and should restrict imports to 2 or 3 models of highly durable vehicles, which can manage all trails at low speed. This would simplify maintenance and the stocking of spare parts, permit the operation of these vehicles around the clock, and provide maximum fluidity and choice of destination to all citizens. This would require the engineering of all-purpose vehicles with the simplicity of the Model T, making use of the most modern alloys to guarantee durability, with a built-in speed limit of not more than 15 miles per hour, and strong enough to run on the roughest terrain. Such vehicles are not on the market because there is no demand for them. As a matter of fact, such a demand would have to be cultivated, quite possibly under the protection of strict legislation. At present, whenever such a demand is even slightly felt, it is quickly snuffed out by counter-publicity aimed at universal sales of the machines which currently extract from U.S. taxpayers the money needed for building superhighways. In order to, quote-unquote, improve transportation, all countries, even the poorest, now plan highway systems designed for the passenger cars and high-speed trailers which fit the velocity-conscious minority of producers and consumers in the elite classes. This approach is frequently rationalized as a savings of the most precious resource of a poor country, the time of the doctor, the school inspector, or the public administrator. These men, of course, serve almost exclusively the same people who have, or hope one day to have, a car. local taxes and scarce international exchange are wasted on false public utilities. Modern technology transferred to poor countries falls into three large categories: goods, factories which make them, and service institutions, principally schools, which make men into modern producers and consumers. Most countries spend by far the largest proportion of their budget on schools. The school-made graduates then create a demand for other conspicuous utilities, such as industrial power, paved highways, modern hospitals and airports, and these in turn create a market for the goods made for rich countries, and, after a while, the tendency to import obsolescent factories to produce them. Of all false utilities, school is the most insidious. Highway systems produce only a demand for cars. Schools create a demand for the entire set of modern institutions which crowd the right end of the spectrum. A man who questioned the need for highways would be written off as a romantic. A man who questions the need for school is immediately attacked as either heartless or imperialist. Schools as false public utilities. Like highways, schools, at first glance, give the impression of being equally open to all comers. They are, in fact, open only to those who consistently renew their credentials. Just as highways create the impression that their present level of cost per year is necessary if people are to move, so schools are presumed essential for attaining the competence required by a society which uses modern technology. We have exposed speedways as spurious public utilities by noting their dependence on private automobiles. Schools are based upon the equally spurious hypothesis that learning is the result of curricular teaching. Highways result from a perversion of the desire and need for mobility into the demand for a private car. Schools themselves pervert the natural inclination to grow and learn into the demand for instruction. Demand for manufactured maturity is a far greater abnegation of self-initiated activity than the demand for manufactured goods. Schools are not only to the right of highways and cars, they belong near the extreme of the institutional spectrum occupied by total asylums. Even the producers of body counts kill only bodies. By making men abdicate the responsibility for their own growth, school leads many to a kind of spiritual suicide. Highways are paid for in part by those who use them, since tolls and gasoline taxes are extracted only from drivers. School, on the other hand, is a perfect system of regressive taxation, where the privileged graduates ride on the back of the entire paying public. School puts a head tax on promotion. The underconsumption of highway mileage is not nearly so costly as the underconsumption of schooling. The man who does not own a car in Los Angeles may be almost immobilized, but if he can somehow manage to reach a workplace, he can get and hold a job. The school dropout has no alternative route. The suburbanite with his new Lincoln and his country cousin who drives a beat-up jalopy get essentially the same use out of the highway, even though one man's car costs 30 times more than the other's. The value of a man's schooling is a function of the number of years he has completed and of the costliness of the schools he has attended. The law compels no one to drive, whereas it obliges everyone to go to school. The analysis of institutions according to their present placement on a left-right continuum enables me to clarify my belief that fundamental social change must begin with a change of consciousness about institutions, and to explain why the dimension of a viable future turns on the rejuvenation of institutional style. During the 60s, institutions born in different decades since the French Revolution simultaneously reached old age. Public school systems founded in the time of Jefferson or of Ataturk, along with others which started after World War II, all became bureaucratic, self-justifying, and manipulative. The same thing happened to systems of social security, to labor unions, major churches and diplomacies, the care of the aged, and the disposal of the dead. Today, for instance, the school systems of Colombia, Britain, the USSR, and the US resemble each other more closely than US schools of the late 1890s resembled either today's or their contemporaries in Russia. Today, all schools are obligatory, open-ended, and competitive. The same convergence in institutional style affects healthcare, merchandising, personnel administration, and political life. All these institutional processes tend to pile up at the manipulative end of the spectrum. A merger of world bureaucracies results from this convergence of institutions. The style, the ranking systems, and the paraphernalia from textbook to computer are standardized on the planning boards of Costa Rica or Afghanistan after the model of Western Europe. Everywhere, these bureaucracies seem to focus on the same task, promoting the growth of institutions of the right. They are concerned with the making of things, the making of ritual rules, and the making and reshaping of executive truth, the ideology or fiat which establishes the current value which should be attributed to their product. Technology provides these bureaucracies with increasing power on the right hand of society. The left hand of society seems to wither, not because technology is less capable of increasing the range of human action and providing time for the play of individual imagination and personal creativity, but because such use of technology does not increase the power of an elite which administers it. The postmaster has no control over the substantive use of the mails. The switchboard operator or Bell telephone executive has no power to stop adultery, murder, or subversion from being planned over his network. At stake in the choice between the institutional right and left is the very nature of human life. Man must choose whether to be rich in things or in the freedom to use them. He must choose between alternate styles of life and related production schedules. Aristotle had already discovered that making and acting are different, so different, in fact, that one never includes the other. Quote, "For neither is acting a way of making, nor making a way of truly acting. Architecture, techne, is a way of making, of bringing something into being whose origin is in the maker and not in the thing. Making has always an end other than itself, action not. For good action itself is its end. Perfection in making is an art. Perfection in acting is a virtue." End quote. The word which Aristotle employed for making was poesis, and the word he employed for doing, praxis. A move to the right implies that an institution is being restructured to increase its ability to make, while as it moves to the left, it is being restructured to allow increased doing or praxis. Modern technology has increased the ability of man to relinquish the making of things to machines, and his potential time for acting has increased. Making the necessities of life has ceased to take up his time. Unemployment is the result of this modernization. It is the idleness of a man for whom there is nothing to make and who does not know what to do, that is, how to act. Unemployment is the sad idleness of a man who, contrary to Aristotle, believes that making things or working is virtuous and that idleness is bad. Unemployment is the experience of the man who has succumbed to the Protestant ethic. Leisure, according to Weber, is necessary for man to be able to work. For Aristotle, work is necessary for man to have leisure. Technology provides man with discretionary time he can fill either with making or with doing. The choice between sad unemployment and joyful leisure is now open for the entire culture. It depends on the institutional style the culture chooses. This choice would have been unthinkable in an ancient culture built either on peasant agriculture or on slavery. It has become inevitable for post-industrial man. One way to fill available time is to stimulate increased demands for the consumption of goods and simultaneously for the production of services. The former implies an economy which provides an ever-growing array of ever-newer things which can be made, consumed, wasted, and recycled. The latter implies the futile attempt to make virtuous actions into the products of service institutions. This leads to the identification of schooling as education, of medical service as health, of program watching as entertainment, of speed as effective locomotion. This first option now goes under the name of development. The radically alternative way to fill available time is a limited range of more durable goods, and to provide access to institutions which can increase the opportunity and desirability of human interaction. A durable goods economy is precisely the contrary of an economy based on planned obsolescence. A durable goods economy means a constraint on the bill of goods. Goods would have to be such that they provided the maximum opportunity to do something with them. Items made for self-assembly, self-help, reuse, and repair. The complement to a durable, repairable, and reusable bill of goods is not an increase of institutionally produced services, but rather an institutional framework which constantly educates to action, participation, and self-help. The movement of our society from the present, in which all institutions gravitate towards post-industrial bureaucracy, to a future of post-industrial conviviality, in which the intensity of action would prevail over production, must begin with a renewal of style in the service institutions, and first of all with a renewal of education. A future which is desirable and feasible depends on our willingness to invest our technological know-how into the growth of convivial institutions. In the field of educational research, this amounts to the request for a reversal of present trends. That was Chapter 4, Institutional Spectrum, of Ivan Illich's Deschooling Society. I'd now like to read something from the website essayingdifferences.com with the subtitle Doing the Opposite of What Schools Normally Do. This is by Philip Bala, and it's called Our Normal Conceits, Though Too the Blackbird is Involved. Ethics for Accumulating as Opposed to Those for Connecting. Legend of the Tower of Babel has it that, when our ancestors began building it, seeking to rise above their looming dangers then, all originally spoke the same language. But as that tower rose, tier upon tier, those in its different parts lost the ability to communicate with those in other parts. All began speaking Babel, metaphor for our first separations into entirely separate languages, as failure to connect came in exact proportion to our first efforts in withdrawing into safety zones. Babel has not receded. Our schools feed it. In the humanities, especially, more than ever now, departments self-isolate, all into their own turfs of jargon, conferencing circuits and methodologies keyed to corporate textbooks. Degree and tenure aspirants in all the mutually exclusive compartments fit specialized niches, such as Robert Frost described in his poem Mending Wall, where he is all pine and I am all apple orchard. Things differ in the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, and the biological branches, where complex systems thinking yet spurs bridging of departmental and disciplinary lines. Though Harvard paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould once noted how none of his younger colleagues could ever get the tenure he got if any wrote as digressively as he. Robert Frost could play with the ways we fence ourselves in, how we reduce ourselves by banalities, such as good fences make good neighbors. In his great essay on metaphorical thinking, Education by Poetry, he explains how all imaginative freedom depends on the metaphors we accept, explaining, too, the extent of tunnel vision still true today. The metaphors, of course, have changed. Now, for instance, tropes of freedom tantalize us thanks to advertisers who have sold us on the ease of escaping urban complications simply by getting in some vehicle. So our landscapes fill with tens of millions of autos and mammoth SUVs hurtling us, usually one per vehicle, along interstate and other highways all too typically glutted with those in dreams like ours. There we move, if we move, with eyes trained on depersonalized horizon points, ticking off mileage markers at best, at worst ticked off by road rage or gridlock. We have tropes of cornucopia abundance, too, thanks to other advertisers, wedding us to sprawls landscapes of fast food ease and theme park shopping malls. Frost understood. He saw not just our dependence on metaphors, but their inevitability, however they vary from generation to generation, religion to religion, climate to climate. All are cultural forms everywhere the world over, all styles of clothing, food, transport, buildings, and landscape at once come from and shape every culture's prevailing metaphors. Though we all still nurture the oldest dreams, safety, security, predictability, no one equates them literally anymore with those old towers of Babel. We have newer promises, newer metaphors just for us. Each culture has its celebrity faces to stoke the happy possibilities that we, too, may elevate ourselves beyond danger, separate ourselves from complications. The industrialized world has globalism and its metaphors of abundance, things to buy, to own, cushion one's life with. Via Gap, Nike, Ford, Coke, Levi's, Singular, Microsoft, Starbucks, GE, Coach, Hershey's, KFC, Miller Lite, Disney, Kodak, Revlon, Rolex, Sony, iPod, Nautilus, IKEA, Marlboro. As if, yes, we are finally proving wrong that Nazarene who long ago warned about the rich as easily entering heaven as camels through the eyes of needles. Globalism sells the metaphors of having stuff, which serves the mythologies of winning, of imagining ourselves at the top or successfully withdrawn. This life celebrates piling on, not connection. We don't need others except as audience. Others reduced to binary set, those in our scripts or not in them. When we do this, projecting everybody else according to simple scripts, scripts dedicated to us accumulating our stuff, we not only deny ourselves the ability to see otherwise, but we blind ourselves to how massively, too, we disrupt the world. As our primary metaphors set entitlement conceits in self-perpetuating cycles, they also keep us from seeing the ways we recklessly extract the world's natural resources, apply its cheap labor to our big box values, and locate all cultures as annexes to ours. Innocence on one hand, missionary superiority on the other, feed each other. We scarcely realize how our empire has now sown a worldwide megalopolis culture of 24 third world cities, each of more than 10 million souls. We deny ourselves the ability to see the multiple levels of loss from such global population transfers, deaths of traditional cultures, millions of idioms, manners, and rituals as alternative metaphors lost, along with those lives formerly in farming, ranching, forestry, and fishing. So many souls stripped of what poet Joseph Brodsky defended as the vitality of loose ends. Canaries in the Mines of Globalism Empire, Sarawewa, Hawi, Mafuz, Taor. Do we do this to them? But we're the good guys, even with our happy sprawl culture, no? One of our first rock and roll songs back in the early 1950s was about a car, the Rocket 88. Within 10 years of that, Jan and Dean had Dead Man's Curve, the Everly Brothers' Wake Up Little Susie, and the Beach Boys' one happy hymn after another to the car and California cruising. We good innocents could tell ourselves, okay, if the rest of the world prefers quaint, funny, traditional culture to the little old lady from Pasadena, let them have it, except for one slight fact. To fuel our interstate highway system, to gas up our cars and SUVs, to spark theme park malls and neon strips, we Americans expect cheap gas. To keep it cheap, a third the price of any other country in the industrialized world, our government for 60 years has followed our oil companies in propping up regimes across the world for our fossil fuel fix. This orchestration of U.S. government and corporate interest were what all meant when, with the Cold War era, all chanted national security. All used Cold War fears for the massive international loans for the many right-wing dictatorships we set up. These in turn floated our own CEO payoffs, stock returns, and the marriage of lobbyists and universities wed to arms, munitions, and related corporate interests. Of course, the blonde children of California could bliss out to Beach Boy hymns and Haight-Ashbury fumes. The entire state of California could coast along on defense contracts, missiles, aerospace, and electronics, that dwarfed all sales from both Hollywood and Central Valley Farms. From Nigeria to Egypt, Iran to Saudi Arabia, and as far off as Indonesia, we installed, subsidized, and supported dictatorships as brutal as any in the Moscow orbit. The profligacy of our international bank loans assured nepotism, cronyism, and corruption through all these oil resource allies. And, to prop them further, our military helped build their Royal Security, Presidential Guard, and secret police to harass, arrest, torture, and murder anyone in their countries against the playboys, mansions, fast cars, and nightclubs these dictatorships flaunted. In Saudi Arabia, Persia, Guatemala, Cuba, Indonesia, Nigeria, Chile, Egypt, our CIA set up and monitored such machineries loyal to our corporate interests. But this same CIA embarrassed itself over and over again, as it never saw or imagined the scale of resentment among local peoples, our environmental deprivations on them, economies reduced to colonial monocultures, and health and education systems widen gaps between rich and poor. Why did so few of us ever hear the names of playwright Ken Sarawewa in Nigeria, poet Khalil Hawi in Lebanon, Nobel laureate Naguib Mahfouz in Egypt, and novelist Pramudya Ananta Tawar in Indonesia? All first-rate writers, they all saw firsthand the effect of our policies despoiling their lands, corrupting their governments, impoverishing their people. Each of these men respectively suffered persecution, suicide, stabbing, and lengthy imprisonment for their observations. The one factor that unites them, oil. Even in the case of Hawi, who came from a country with no international petroleum extraction, their art all hinged on the dislocations affecting their countrymen. Art differing in many ways, but all stirred by our government in thrall to our corporate moneyed metaphors. At any American university, one can find those who know the names Sarawewa, Hawi, Mahfouz, and Tawar, though no one would know all four. These, the best voices of their cultures, speak from metaphors far from ours. Our literature and other humanities departments dedicate themselves to such feigned neutrality and niche specialization that such oddly disparate dots never connect, never touch any human culture related to ours. Yet the blackbird is involved. In their embrace of mutually isolated niches, those in the new metaphors of Babel neither touch nor see those in the parallel corporate flowchart departments. But if you ask any of them about their abilities to cross-reference, to cite others nearby or cross-campus, they'll respond that they can do that. They will claim that they can mention text and authors in other fields, though students, when polled, hugely say they never see this happen. But our corporate professors aren't alone in inflating themselves. Those in the most recently elected administration in Washington have also assumed their success succoring each other in corporate lives should automatically carry over elsewhere. Thus, they could assume quick fix for cultures in Southwest Asia simply by an invading army. They could assume this. Bush, Cheney, Rove, Rumsfeld, Rice, Libby, Wolfowitz, Pearl, Addington, Yu, Gonzalez. Partly because they had all led lives in corporate cocoons, where always others, never they or their families, experience military risk. They could assume the ease of imposing their culture on others, too, because none had ever imagined any other culture, never learned any of the Arabic, Farsi, Urdu, or Kurdish of their target countries, had never taken seriously either the languages or the literatures and metaphors of Southwest Asia. Clearly, none had ever read our own David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest. If they had, they'd have seen how their Democrat predecessors had similarly mired in military adventurism abroad, in Vietnam, thanks, in their turn, to their having taken for granted the easy transfer of their cultural metaphors, that their statistical flowcharts, corporate hierarchies, and material delivery systems equated anywhere and everywhere with progress, democracy, freedom, and consumer happiness. When one feels entitled, one has taken for granted one's cultural metaphors. Those who built that first Tower of Babel made the same assumptions, the same metaphors for building and safety, as if life were but a matter of adding on, filling out tiers of rooms, filling them too with stuff, as naively as our developers add freeway lanes, gated communities, and all the subsidized utilities of suburban sprawl. Do others have metaphors for the ethics of social linking and responsibility to nature? Might we hear some like Sarah Wewa, Hawi, Makfouz, and Taur on how our culture might have a few glitches affecting, say, masses of largely Islamic people elsewhere? Poet Joseph Brodsky called it loose ends, the way odd things may awaken us, the way metaphors, puns, and rhymes may let us see beyond initial assumptions. He considered good poetry primarily an artifice of loose ends, brewing surprise so some tropes supplant others, showing different sides that may matter, that something other might be going on. In 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, another poet, Wallace Stevens, suggested how other levels of things may always be going on, that we might well value connections to others, emotional debts scarcely fathomed. I know noble accents and lucid, inescapable rhythms, but I know, too, that the blackbird is involved in what I know. Blackbirds sing, like canaries who, in a mine shaft, may assure us of good air or indicate something we had better check out. Poets serve thus. Reciprocal responsibility to be nudged, to reconcile other views, depends on us willing to see other levels of metaphor, other ways we connect, and others too. Joseph Brodsky considered good poetry to act as bushes, brambles, or rhizome networks. Things don't just add up, but rather connect. In good poetry, in any decent ethics, life radiates more than some colonizing souls imposing on others. Radiates the good of more ways of seeing others. That was Our Normal Conceits, Though Too the Blackbird is Involved, from EssayingDifferences.com by Philip Bala. Read by Teresa Caraggio at thirdparadigm.org.
Previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, which is unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's also a mailing list for any discussion of the show at altruists.org/unwelcome. And we have a Twitter feed announcing new episodes at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. The music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.